The main thrust, I think, of the questions was, I think there was some skepticism. I know from feedback later that some people believed us, some people were very skeptical. But the major thing was the point the one guy who asked most of the questions was, there has to be documentation of this. You're not going to get anywhere without documentation, which I knew. But, I mean, we were just kind of at the beginning of this process. But it was like in that moment, they believed, I think. And then after they had time to reflect, the reality is, this was not a hearing about mind control.
Mm-hmm.
We were given a lot of time. Half an hour is a lot of time. Most people get 2 or 3 minutes to say their thing, or 5 minutes at the most. So to be given, we were told this by the ACRE people, who is the Citizen Oversight Committee.
Mm-hmm.
They gave us a lot of time. They were very interested. They followed up in everything that we told them. So in that sense. And then what happened was the survivors across the country, as the word got out, deluged them with phone calls and letters, and it was that follow-up that made it believable. We broke the ice and broke the silence and gave them the overview. The other thing that was amazing was when we came down from testifying and went back to our seats, we were mobbed by the radiation people. People coming up and saying things like, you knew Dr. Green? I knew Dr. Green. Wasn't he a bastard? Or someone coming up and saying, now I know what Dr. Green did to me. And other people saying, now I know what my loved one, because there were people representing people who had died, now I know what my loved one was saying. And it turns out that the overlap between the mind control and the radiation, I mean, we've been looking at radiation and people being sick in the mind control population. Well, it turns out that there was mind control also in the radiation population. And so that kind of overlap was really interesting. But I think it was the backup support from all the people, all the survivors in the country, that really pushed it. And then what they did is they put everything we asked for and we recommended is in the final report of the Radiation Commission, which is to reveal and make public all human experimentation documents, you know, and that there will be a suspicion and there will be inquiries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, until that is done. And that was really one of the things we were trying to do.
Right. Did you find out what the response of the U.S. government was to the advisory committee? After after the final report, after the final report,
radiation.
No, as far as the mind control, most of our listeners realize that President Clinton did give a public apology to the radiation victims and some compensation to some of the victims.
Right.
But specifically about the mind control information.
Now, it wasn't part of their charge, so it wouldn't have been appropriate for them to do that.
They just made recommendations that this should
They made recommendations in the final report. The other thing that happened after we testified is that the ACRE people, who is the citizen committee,
mm-hmm.
there's always a citizen committee that arranges for the witnesses and oversees the process and makes sure that the information gets put before the committee, the commission. And they, the head of it, Cooper Brown, met with me and said, you have to get a hearing. And he gave me the whole blueprint of how they did it, how they got a hearing.
So
I was writing furiously, you know, to sort of, and got the whole blueprint of how to get a hearing. And I've written that up, and I've given it at a conference in Dallas a year ago, and again this year was given out. I think it's been published on the internet, and the AICS-MC, which is the advocacy group for the mind control survivors, is following that blueprint.
Mm-hmm. And AICS-MC and other survivors are calling for the U.S. government and Canadian government to open investigations into the mind control experimentation. What further do you think needs to have happened to force the governments to open this kind of commission of inquiry?
I have no idea. I think it just needs to be the groundswell of support and more people and more people and more people writing, talking, pushing, Because I think that's what happened with the Radiation Commission. So many people wrote to them and called them and backed us up that they really had to take it seriously. And I think that that's probably the thing here, is that people need to write and keep writing and keep advocating and be appropriate, you know, and just keep going and going and going. The other thing is and I really also think that while it would be nice to get a hearing tomorrow, it isn't a bad thing that this is taking time, because we need people healed who are not going to be triggered, who are, because they're going to be triggering, trying to trigger people left and right if they go testify. So we need time for people to heal before we go testify. I mean, I know that Chris, what Chris and Claudia did was extremely courageous, because they were having constant flashbacks the whole time we went to Washington and in Washington and before and after testifying. It was extremely painful and difficult for them to do that, extremely. And then, and so you know, their courage and was just astounding. But I think that if we can get people through the process and free, and that can happen, but and healed, that we will present a much better case.
How do you think the public, the state of the public understanding of these issues around mind control? You know, we've been seeing the U.S. government coming forward and apologizing for experimenting on humans, as in the Tuskegee experiments and radiation experiments. So I think people have a you know, there is a sense of distrust of the government and a sense that, yes, this is possible. But what is your sense of the public understanding of the issues around this? Because it does seem to take a bit to understand everything.
Actually, I've been kind of surprised. You know, I have a normal life aside from this, and I have, you know, I come into contact with people, and sometimes it comes up what it is that I do, and sometimes people are skeptical, but you know what? Most people believe it without any trouble, without any doubt. These are educated people. Sometimes they're skeptical, but, you know, that's good. We'll have a discussion about it. But it's like, a lot of times what I get is, I can believe that happened. And sometimes, and this just really blows my mind, is if it comes up in a social situation or whatever, because my husband will say something or I'll say something and people pursue it or whatever, I am astounded at how many people can name the people locally here that were involved in it and have some degree of knowledge, professionals. It just, I mean, it was not that big a secret. I don't think, I don't know, but I am absolutely astounded. And so I've gotten validation and verification from people in the community, because instantly there's one name, that, and I'm not going to tell names, I'm not going to talk names today, but there's a name that comes to mind, because this is local and, you know, it doesn't pertain. But, you know, and that just kind of blows me away. I met a psychologist at a party a couple of years ago, and I was talking to him a little bit, and I always kind of test people a little bit to see their tolerance for this. And he said, oh, yeah, I interviewed as a psychologist for the CIA in 1980 and or 1975 or something. And he said, and I talked to so-and-so, and he told me all about it. And it was one of the key people that has been named by the client. So, I mean, I'm astounded by the people that sort of have this knowledge in the professional community. And then I think also it's been on TV a lot, X-Files. You know, it was, I always wondered why the X-Files got their facts so accurately, because they've talked about MKUltra, and they've shown mind control, and they do a really good job. And I think I told you, but a couple weeks ago I got called by them, which was really exciting, for some background information. And they do research on their shows. So they're not just making this stuff up. And it's other places, too, in the media. So I think that people I think, see it more than you realize. And, they believe it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't seen the X-Files too much, but they do tend to put a lot of the surface information, but they do also, I notice, put their own spins on their reasons of why this is happening and who's responsible.
Yeah, they do. They do. But this time, what they were looking for is the specific people. So I don't know what is coming up or whatever. Hmm. But it was neat for me because my son, who's in college, basically said to me, "Oh, good, now I have something to brag to my friends about." My stock with him went way up, you know, the fact that, because we're both real big fans of The X-Files. Mm.
After the experience of giving testimony and being contacted by other therapists and survivors after the hearings, what's your sense of how prevalent mind control is from your experience in talking to other therapists across the continent?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I think trauma therapists or people that work with trauma like me, who really have studied it and thought about it and read, and I think we probably have clients like that. I don't know how many have been identified. My feeling is it's possibly tens of thousands, and I mean more than, I don't know. It's really hard to say how many.
Mm-hmm. What would your advice be to other therapists that may be coming across accounts of mind control experimentation? What kind of information resources are there? You'd mentioned that you yourself had been doing workshops. Have other therapists also been providing
that? Yeah, there's been other people across the country that are doing workshops. I mean, basically right now, I think it's mostly word of mouth. I think we've been kind of reluctant to talk or to write about it. I've had a hard time because I had to have a handle on it. I have a handle on it now, and I'm going to look at and when I get time, but writing some stuff. But there's really basically not much published on this that's accessible to mainstream therapists. So most of it is word of mouth at this point.
Now, I'd like to talk about how prevalent are memories of ritual abuse and sexual abuse in the clients that have undergone mind control experimentation.
They all report sexual, physical, and emotional abuse, and the systematic, I mean, the words are kind of the same in terms of the messages they're given about that they're worthless and that they'll never be a success, or you know, all that kind of stuff, really, really downing their self-esteem, really taking away their control. I lost your question.
How prevalent are the memories of ritual abuse in the mind control
survivors? I have clients that have no memory of any kind of ritual abuse. I have clients whose memories of ritual abuse are clinical and laboratory, that I think that what happened was, well, first of all, let me say what ritual abuse, I think ritual abuse is, and mm-hmm. those of us who've dealt with it a lot think it is. I think it's basically, most of the time, sex rings that get together and use costumes to terrify kids and keep them under control. And Satan is a good image because of religion. Here they use Mardi Gras costumes. I have a couple clients that have talked about that. But basically they're groups of pedophiles engaged in child prostitution, and sometimes you hear about child pornography. So it's, some of it I think is organized crime dealing with child pornography and child prostitution. And some of it I think, is just groups of pedophiles, men and women, who get together and have their do whatever they want with kids. And I think the satanic imagery heightens the excitement for them or whatever. And then I think there may be true satanic cults, but I guess the thing that's always been missing for me is how it shows up in your daily life. If you're a practicing Satanist, I think that it's something that would show up in your daily life or show up in rituals or whatever, but it doesn't. And so that kind of leads me to believe that it's really for another purpose, which is to terrify kids and keep them under control. So that's how I see ritual abuse. I think what happened was is when Green started screening kids, because apparently there were several criteria for selecting kids for the project. One was that they already had to have been traumatized somewhat and have the ability to dissociate. Another was they had to have good memories. And another was that they had to be really intelligent. Those were care. And I think as time went on, he looked for compliant kids because there were some real rebellious ones that fought him. But when you look at that, I think that he at some point came across the fact that some of these kids were already being abused in sex rings. And so a lot of the, one of the things they wanted to do was to make kids forget or have amnesia for stuff that was happening to them. Well, there are a number of ways of doing that. Trauma is one of the best ways of inducing amnesia for an event. So what he would do is he would order a trauma. And if they had a sex ring backing up or lurking in the background, he would just send them back for them to be ritually abused again. And that would create a ritual abuse memory. And then he would do his thing, and then he'd send them back again, sort of like a, Claudia describes it like a sandwich. So you have a trauma with ritual abuse. You have, you go back to the laboratory, Green does his nasty little thing, and then you have another trauma after, and they were spaced in certain ways in order to maximize the dissociative effect and maximize the amnesia for what Green was doing. So they were allowed to remember the ritual abuse, but that was supposed to keep therapists busy, busy, busy for a long period of time. And you were never, ever, ever supposed to get to the mind control stuff. And all my clients have told me this. Then, so that's one way it happened. Then another way it happened was if there was not a sex ring or satanic what a cult or whatever in the background or there readily available, then I think Green produced the same kind of effect in the laboratory and introduced images of Satan. People in costumes did the same kinds of stuff, but you get more of a sense of it's not as full. It's not as much abuse, and there isn't as much ceremony or learning that takes place like it does in the ritual abuse. You know, I mean, the more, you know, if there's a sex ring in the background. So that also, and then I have clients that report neither.
So do you think the accounts of ritual abuse, do you think many are kind of faked scenes of rituals, or how much do you think could be real or and how much faked?
I think some of it is real. I mean, it is all real in terms of what the child experiences, but in terms of faking scenes or doing little plays to convince them of stuff and that kind of stuff, I think there was a lot of that.
Right.
I mean, that's what I find when people start remembering and they start remembering. See, it's like a lot of times they'll have double memory. They'll have a memory of what actually took place, and then they have a memory of what they were led to believe took place. And basically, all I have to do is once someone tells me something, I'll just say, is there anything else? You know, and I will always say that, is there anything else? Is there anything else? Is there anything else? Until they tell me, no, there's nothing else. And then I'll still ask, are you sure? Is there anything else? And then eventually they get to, there's nothing else. But you find these double memories or tricks. Like, for example, all the child murders that you hear about, A lot of times what I find is you have a child who's terrified, who's abused, who's dissociating in trance-like state, who's drugged, and they witness something, and they think a child got murdered, and they think they did it. And they did it in all kinds of ways. Like, for example, one of my clients would wake up with blood all over her hands, and she would see this thing on the table and was told, this is a baby, and you stabbed it to death, and you stabbed it so hard, it has no character. Well, basically, she said it was, when she, I said, well, what is really on the table? And it was either a roast or a liver, or sometimes they would have a real baby. But what I have, what I'll ask then, is there a smell in the room? And they'll think about it a minute and say, oh, it's formaldehyde. Well, the reason there's formaldehyde smell is because these are doctors. They have access to, they keep, like certain children that die or whatever, if they're going to do research or tissue or whatever, they keep them in, for they preserve them.
And it's possible.
And so what they do is they bring these bodies of, you know, babies that died at birth or were born deformed or whatever. And so if you get the formaldehyde smell, you know that this corpse came from a hospital. And so, or what they will do is show them a child, distract their attention, and substitute a doll. That's why a lot of times you'll hear the victims, especially in the 50s, 60s, and maybe even into the 70s, you'll hear a lot of times they'll talk about the child having blonde hair and blue eyes. Well, the reason is because dolls at that time were mostly blonde hair and blue eyes.
What are, you mentioned some of the uses of, you know, why they would be going to this length in experimenting with this kind of technology. What uses were they putting mind control technology to?
Well, I think the original thing is you have to think about post-World War II and the Cold War. A lot of it was, from what I understand, was panic about the Russians or someone else gaining an edge and being able to infiltrate America and gain control of the citizens or the military or whatever. I think they were very taken off guard, maybe, or I don't know about what happened to prisoners in, you know, the war with Japan, you know, in World War II with Japan and the Asians, because they had perfected or were doing a lot of brainwashing stuff and the effects on American prisoners. The Korean War certainly spurred it, and that became more public. And I think that they were looking to see if there were uses in terms of creating spies. And what is the perfect spy? It is someone with DID, who core birth personality goes on vacation someplace. A part comes out, makes contact. Another part comes out, makes the meeting. Another part comes out, and each part has amnesia for the other. It's like a string. You know, each one has a piece of the puzzle, but nobody puts it all together. They go and they're sexual, or they assassinate, or they do whatever they're supposed to do. Another part records everything that goes on and remembers it. And then another part gets them out of there, and then the core birth personality comes back and continues the vacation. Well, if she or he gets caught and is interrogated, all the amnesia barriers are in place, plus they've been conditioned to withstand a lot of pain, so they won't get any information. And that is, in effect, probably the perfect spy or the perfect operative or whatever. I've also heard of other people being used, being trained, like in computer technology or physics or, you know, I don't know, whatever, and then being called on, altars being taken someplace and do work, and they don't have to pay for it. And I've heard of clients being asked to, or going on a plane somewhere. They get called and they go somewhere and do something and then come back. So so I think that they put a lot of money into these people, and I would think that they're using them still.
If what the survivors of mind control are saying is true, and we seem to be living in times where the political elites and the government and CIA have access to mind control technology and have had so for many decades.
Yeah.
And we've heard stories in the interview with Claudia Mullen about how she was used to blackmail other government officials, military officials, to coerce them to toe the line.
Right.
What other dangers do you see to society if what these survivors are saying is true? What other dangers are there?
Just the fact is that this is like a cancer, you know? I mean, this evil is like a cancer in our society. I mean, it really poisons things. Just to think about that this exists and that it can continue in secrecy. I know I've talked to some reporters who've told me that they know about that there's a shadow government that is really running things behind the scenes. And that the elected officials or the people that are public and whatever have no idea that it exists, or if they do, they're powerless to do anything about it. So that's really scary. How much of control that a group of people that no one appointed them, no one elected them, are running things behind the scenes. But I think the fact that morally or ethically, as a society, if we turn a blind eye to people being abused, if we don't care, if we numb out, then I think we're headed for disaster, because the kind of predication of developing a democracy or whatever, or of Christian or Judeo-Christian values, is that you care about your neighbor. And if people stop caring because they numb out, then I think that we're in for bad trouble. Because mm-hmm. all kinds of atrocities can happen. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you also about how the popular media and icons and imagery are being used in the mind control programming. What's your experience of that?
Well, it seems to me that there's a lot more in the last 5 years. A lot more imagery. My clients are pointing out to me things that are deliberately triggering. Now, how much of that was planned? Green was brilliant. And how much of that was planned and that it's always been there and it's becoming more prevalent, or how much of it is being planted into the media, I don't know. But it seems to me that there's a whole desensitization of the American Canadian public in terms of satanic imagery, in terms of things that we would consider evil or bad, that there's this whole desensitization process that's going on in terms of increased violence in the media, in terms of increased images of Satanism, symbols, just being desensitized to the abuse stuff, desensitized to violence, desensitized to sex. I mean, there seems to be a lot going on in terms of that. And I think people's tolerance for this kind of stuff is greater than it used to be. And also, I wonder how much of this is also aimed at survivors in terms of triggering them so that they'll be triggered into killing themselves or hurting themselves, getting in hospitals, so that they don't talk. Because people are beginning to remember now. And there are people who have always remembered who have never been able to talk about it. And they're beginning to be able to talk about it because the therapeutic community, the therapists, are beginning to understand more. So now they can talk to us because we're not going to view them as crazy if they start talking about this. I mean, if you think about it, it is pretty bizarre. And my clients will say that this is really bizarre, and I'll agree with that. It is. This is really bizarre stuff. Unfortunately, everything I get back from the researchers in terms of validation is that, bizarre as it is, it's true. You know, there's a lot of truth to what they're saying.
These researchers like Alan Shefflin, you mentioned,
like
have spent years...
Who's gotten source CIA documents.
Right, through Freedom of Information Act.
He said to me one time that he'd been doing this research for like 15 or 20 years, and he could never find the victims. And he never dreamed that the victims were children.
That concludes our interview with Valerie Wolf. Stay tuned next week as we continue this series on mind control here on the International Connection, CKLN 88.1.